Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Here are some articles from the February-March issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Editor's note. Home is where the stuff is. By Hunter Hawk. Let's face it. Our worlds and priorities are different from what they were this time last year, and our personal spaces have never mattered more. That's one of the reasons why we're introducing a new home and ranch section, expanding our shelter coverage with a lot of inspiring ideas. Contributing writer Rhonda Reinhart brings a wealth of experience to her mission to cover the best in the American West, and we're excited to bring you her curation of trends, interiors, and makers. I know a thing or two about rethinking a living space. I've moved 3 times in the last 18 months. A lengthier commute, a tornado, and most recently, a worldwide pandemic have spurred these relocation decisions. I'm settled now, thank goodness, and I'm also a newly minted expert on fitting my stuff into any set of rooms. My decorating approach trends to drive the completist in my family nuts. I will idle for months at a time with nothing on the main living room wall, just because it's so dang difficult to commit. Yet, when the perfect piece finally reveals itself at a store, online, or even a flea market, I always find the result to be worth the wait, until I get sick of it and rearrange everything again. My latest living room is filled with the stuff that, as the newly fashionable tidy minimalists would put it, sparks joy. Certain items have been with me as long as I can remember. A table my mom and I painted and stained one summer after a trip to the flea market Mecca of Canton, Texas. A Peter Stevens portrait of Will Rogers tipping his hat at a train station. Is he saying hello or goodbye? It changes every time the door opens. A framed certificate that declares me a permanent member of the annual Hawk Family Christmas Day Gathering. Knick-knacks, wooden furniture, briar horses, and succulent plants, all of it creates an emotional network of memories and important symbols. The story my living room tells might only make perfect sense to me, but I continually try to make it look nice so that visitors feel at home too. What does your favorite room say about you? What has survived every move you've ever made, and why? I'd love to know and would be glad to receive the stories behind your favorite space at letters@cowboysandindians.com. Maybe one of your favorite things in your place is a certain photograph. An extraordinary image or a meaningful snapshot can really elevate and personalize a room. Whenever our annual reader photo contest rolls around, it strikes me anew how much a great shot can simultaneously capture deep emotion, lived experience, and unforgettable character in a single frame. You have only to look at those contest submissions or the photographs by the fine art photographers we've profiled in this issue, or even your own iPhone, to be reminded of something Dorothea Lange said. The camera is an instrument that teaches people how to see without a camera. The Carroll Legacies and Diverse Descendants. The North American cowboy doesn't encompass just one custom or image, but includes a whole range of traditions and cultures. That's the photogenic point of a new exhibition of roughly 50 photographs at Booth Western Art Museum. Showcasing the many variations on the cowboy theme, it traces the legacy of the first cowboys through many expressions of the Western tradition, highlighting Mexican charros, Indian relay races, and rodeos, Hawaiian paniolas, as well as black rodeos and African-American cowboys. The history of the North American cowboy can be traced back to the early Spanish horsemen, the vaqueros, who brought their craft and traditions to the Americas in 1867, says Booth Curator of Photography, Dr. Samuel Drace III. Since then, cowboy culture can be found from the east to the west coast of the United States, and even in Hawaii. This exhibition is a celebration of those diverse descendants, spanning rodeos to ranching and those in between. Museum Executive Director Seth Hopkins knew of a number of talented photographers who were delving into the cowboy lifestyle, the cowboy mystique, the cowboy way, all different types of people who wound up being cowboys and who might have different lingo and different dress, but were essentially all doing the same job, but doing it differently. The idea for an exhibition that would capture those varied manifestations through the lenses of multiple photographers became Vaquero Legacies and Diverse Descendants. The show features a great cross-section of America, Hopkins says, and brings together color and black and white images from contemporary photographers such as Richard Ducree, Jay Desard, Colin Erie, Antonio Gomez, Anouk Kranz, Nadine Levin, Barbara Van Cleve, Travis Gillett, Ivan McClellan, Julia Coombs, Rosianna Sales, Christopher Pugmeyer, with filmmaker Doug Hancock, and others. Hopkins, and especially drawn to the work of Kranz. She's from France and comes to it a real outsider, with the romantic ideas of a European thinking of the cowboy ideal. Then, after being exposed to the real thing, she found that it wasn't what she thought it was. The authentic blue-collar American, patriotic with all these ideals that a cynical city person in Europe thought was a cliché, is real, or more real than anything that could ever have been in her mind. For Drace, it's difficult to pick a favorite. The photographers in the exhibition each document the breadth of cowboy culture in their own special way. To me, what is striking about the artists, and indeed the exhibition, is their unique styles and subjects. Anouk Kranz transforms the western sky into a huge expanse through the use of stark contrast. Colin Erie documents the Compton Cowboys, blending aspects of documentary and editorial photography to celebrate this group of African Americans as they work to educate and inspire future generations. Richard Ducree uses color and black and white photography to highlight the blend of African, African American, and Western traditions among riders in black rodeos. There's also the work of Antonio Gomez, a photography professor at College of Southern Nevada, whose crisp black and whites of the charrea is a Mexican version of rodeo. Document participants and spectators, charros' traditional clothing, and the vibrant atmosphere of the events. The ways in which long-lived traditions are passed on from generation to generation is central to Gomez's series, Drace says. His work shows the struggle of many Mexican immigrants who make it their mission to pass on equestrian precision and human nobility to the next generation. When you see all of the diverse images together in one exhibition, Drace says, a more holistic picture of the American cowboy begins to emerge.
Hello, this is Michael. I'll be reading articles from the archives of True West magazine. We'll be reading from an edition of True West that was published 30 years ago this month, April 1991. This article is called Toughest Cow Outfit in Texas, Part 1 by R.K. DeArmond. The Millet Ranch in Baylor County, Texas was in operation only 7 years, But in that short period, its riders established a reputation for toughness unmatched in Texas. A.P. Black, a millet hand who cowboyed from Texas to North Dakota and rode with many a hard-bitten crew, called it one of the toughest spots this side of hell. Brothers Eugene, Alonzo, and Hiram Millet, Confederate veterans, returned in 1865 to their Guadalupe County home in southern Texas and found cattle running wild after 4 years of neglect during the Civil War. The Millets, always known on the range as Cap, Lawn, and High, rounded up unbranded longhorns and drove them to northern markets at the Kansas railheads. By 1874, the brothers were looking for new rangeland on which to breed and raise their own herds. On their trail drives, they had passed through the unpopulated and unorganized counties of North Texas. There, on the upper reaches of the Brazos River, were great stretches of fine grassland, capable of supporting large cattle herds. It was open land, virtually free for the cattlemen. In 1874, the Millets moved into this area, built cattle pens in Baylor County, brought in their first herd of 6,000 head, and began developing what 5 years later the Fort Griffin Echo would call the largest cattle ranch in North Texas. For more than a year, they lived and worked out of their wagons. Then in the spring of 1876, the Millets constructed their headquarters on high ground near Miller Creek, a mile north of the Brazos River. They selected a spot right beside the Western Cattle Trail where, as A.P. Black said, "From the porch, a man could stand and watch the herds going by, bound for Dodge City, Honeywell, or Montana." Within a 5-foot-high stone wall enclosure, they erected a 4-room frame house, a separate 1-room building that served as an office, and a rock warehouse designed to be used as a fort if the headquarters came under attack by Indians or outlaws. Portholes for firing stations were built into the rock structure at regular intervals, and rifles provided by the state for protection against Indians were stored there in constant readiness. "It was fixed up just like an arsenal," recalled Black, "with portholes every foot or two, and about the best stock of rifles and ammunition in the state of Texas." The Millet brothers were careful in their selection of cowhands to work this ranch. When the Millets run the spread, there wasn't anybody but a rustler or gunman could get work with them, said Black. "The Millets were a tough outfit, straight through, and hired the toughest bunch of men I ever ran up against. They even paid bonuses to their cowpunchers for every cow or horse they stole." Longtime trail driver F.M. Polk agreed. "Millet worked only desperados on this ranch, but they were all good cattlemen." "They were a tough lot," recalled Jim McIntyre, who during a checkered career as a cowboy, Texas Ranger, boomtown lawman, fugitive, and jailbreaker, established a formidable reputation as a hard case in his own right. He and another former ranger named N.F. Locke kept a saloon at Belknap in Young County in 1878. The closest post office to the Millet spread was at Belknap, and the ranch hands often rode into town to get their mail and belly up to the bar. McIntyre came to know them well. "Millet brothers would not hire a man unless he was a fighter," he said. "They did a lot of shady work and needed good men to execute their plans in raiding the ranges for stray cattle." Don L. Biggers, an early day resident in neighboring Shackelford County, put it succinctly. "When a man got so tough that he couldn't affiliate with civilization, he would go to this Millet ranch and get a job." These characterizations of the Millet riders were overly critical and too general, according to range historian Floyd B. Streeter. The roster of from 35 to 75 men working on the ranch, Streeter admitted, contained a number of hard characters who were wanted for man-killing or cattle-stealing in another community, or who engaged in gun battles while on the ranch payroll. But he felt that these individuals gave the outfit a bad name. The reputation established by the bad actors does the crew an injustice, for several of the employees were honest, upright men. While every Millet cowboy, good or bad, could take care of himself in a fight, the entire group has been judged by those who were on the shady side of the law or shot their way to fame. A.P. Black, however, could name only one Millet cowboy whose reputation was untainted. Jimmy Townsley was, to my knowledge at least, the only square shooter the Millets ever hired, he said. Although Townsley was just as tough as the rest of them, he was a quiet, clean sort of a man who never took advantage of anybody and never acquired anything except what he worked for and was honestly entitled to. There may have been other square shooters among the cowboys who worked for the ranch, but the record shows that Millet riders as a group were a particularly desperate lot, that many were outlawed from other locales, and that they were involved in far more than their share of violent encounters in the few years the ranch was in operation. Jack King was the first foreman the Millet brothers chose to ramrod their hard-boiled crew. One day, he and his cowhands, Pat Walford and Jim Garrison, rode over to the neighboring 6666 spread on the Wichita River to see about some cattle of disputed ownership. S. Burke Burnett, the owner of 6666, had named it, so the story went, after the poker hand which had won it for him, four sixes. Finding some steers with burnt-over brands in a Millet herd, Burnett claimed them and drove them into his corral. When the Millet cowboy showed up, Jack King announced he was going to take the steers back. Burnett said that he wasn't. King started to step off his horse and reach for his handgun with the same motion. Burnett, however, was ready and put a .45 bullet through the foreman's head. Walford and Garrison fled, and the disputed steers remained at the 4-6 corral. Burnett came clear at a Wichita County hearing on the shooting, and he had no further trouble with the Millets. Billy Bland, an experienced trail boss, succeeded King as foreman and ran things differently for a time. A.P. Black said that Bland was the first man to drive a herd from Texas to the Dakotas, delivering 2,500 head of beef steers to the Indian Agency on the Niobrara River. In 1875, Bland took part in the largest northern cattle drive on record when the Millets and Texas cattlemen Seth Mabry, John O. DeWeese, and James F. Ellison combined their herds and sent over 100,000 head of cattle to the Kansas railroads and beyond. Among those going up the trail with Bland were L.B. Anderson, Tom Peeler, Sam and John Wilson, Billy Gray, Charlie Reed, and Whit Vick, several of whom returned to take work at the Millet Ranch. The Millet brothers moved their cattle and horse herds into winter ranges in neighboring Knox and Throckmorton counties. On the night of January 17, 1877, Billy Bland and Charlie Reed rode into the Flat, a tough buffalo hunter town lying under the bluff at Fort Griffin in Shackelford County, Texas, just south of the Throckmorton winter range. What then transpired was colorfully described by a correspondent calling himself Comanche Jim in the pages of the Dallas Daily Herald. Bland and Reed and Comanche Jim, full of old rye and the devil, attempted to hurrah the town, galloping their ponies up and down the single street and firing their six-shooters in the air. Dismounting, they swaggered into the Beehive Saloon, ordered drinks, and flourished their pistols recklessly. Their racket was suddenly stopped, said Comanche Jim, by the appearance of Deputy Sheriff Crozier, William R. Krueger, and County Attorney William Jeffries, who, as officers of the law, commanded them to put up their guns and leave. The order seemed to be the signal for the ball to open. About 10 shots were fired in rapid succession, with, unfortunately, more injury to innocent spectators than to the guilty parties. Mortally wounded in the blast of gunfire was Dan Barron, a recently married young lawyer who was killed instantly by a shot in the forehead, and a former Army lieutenant named Myers, who was shot in the back and died within hours. Both were apparently struck by errant bullets fired by the Millet gunmen. The officers were also hit. Jeffries was struck in the chest by a bullet but survived. Deputy Bill Krueger received only a superficial wound. Krueger's first shot downed Billy Bland, who died within minutes. Charlie Reed retreated from the saloon unscathed. Shocked by the violent scene, Comanche Jim saw Mr. Jeffries led away, barren, on the ground, with his brains oozing through the hole in his forehead. Lieutenant Myers dying, reclining on his side, and Bland rolling on his back in agony. All from the effects of a drunken spree and the useless habit of packing a six-shooter. Charlie Reed escaped on foot and turned up later at a line camp 12 miles west of the flat, where millet hands Newton James and Ernest Campbell helped him provision and ride on. A Shackelford County grand jury indicted him for murder the following April, and Reed appeared on the 1878 Texas List of Fugitives from Justice, which described him as 25 years of age, weight 145 pounds, 5 feet 8 inches high, with black hair and eyes. The notice, composed by Bill Krueger, who was now sheriff of Shackelford County, added that Reed was harbored by Millet Brothers cattlemen. Apparently, Reed was never apprehended. Replacing Bland as ranch foreman was Tom Peeler, a 29-year-old Mississippi native who had come west after the Civil War and worked as a cowboy in Idaho and Wyoming, as well as Texas. Peeler became so well-known on the range as a flint-hard but top-quality ranch hand that his very name became a synonym for cowpunchers across the Southwest, who prided themselves on their toughness. They began to refer to themselves as Peelers. According to A.P. Black, Peeler looked like a walking arsenal. He wore two .45 caliber six-shooters and carried a Winchester and a breech-loading shotgun. His chaps were worked with cartilage loops clean down to the knees and plumb full of ammunition, 44 cartridges on one leg and 45s on the other. Seemed they never made cartridge belts with capacity enough to suit him. While working for the Millets, said Black, Peeler built up his own herd. He had burned his brand, 7-P-L-E-R, on anybody's cattle, and there wasn't a cow in his layout he hadn't stolen. Peeler, however, was highly regarded by the Millet brothers, and when in January 1880 he married Alice Jane Irvin, daughter of Captain Millet's partner, William C. Irvin, his position at the ranch was secure. In the spring of that year, Peeler took a herd of 2,500 cattle to market in Caldwell, Kansas. Violence, always near among his hair-triggered crew, erupted as they neared the Red River. A seemingly playful interchange between two of the drovers quickly escalated into an exchange of pistol fire. One of the riders went down, seriously wounded. The other, believing he had killed the man, galloped off. Now short two hands, Peeler continued on to the railhead. In 1878, when Millet cowboy Doug Hill killed a Mexican line rider, the Millets opened their own private graveyard in a little mesquite clearing about 50 yards from the ranch house, and there they buried the Mexican, name unknown. The second occupant of the cemetery was a man named Lewis, who was killed by Henry Street, a fiery little cowboy who worked several years for the Millets before drifting on west. Street was a foreman on the Spurs Ranch near Luna, New Mexico, where he is reported to have killed another man in a dispute. He worked at the Diamond A near Deming, New Mexico, and later became the highly regarded superintendent of the famous Wagon Rods, the Bukia's Land and Cattle Company of Cochise County, Arizona. A young cowboy from Illinois, remembered only as Yellow House, became the third man the Millets buried in the graveyard. During branding at the Millet Corral, Yellow House was gored by a big bull who, said A.P. Black, picked the cowboy up and whirled him into the air over his head. The animal had ripped Yellow House clean up the belly. But the puncher got out of the dirt and, with his guts in one hand, climbed the 6-foot corral fence with the other. Yellow House allowed a man shouldn't die from a little thing like that and walked unaided up to the ranch house. He died about 9 o'clock the next morning. Doc Wilson from Seymour patched him up some and tried to save him, but it was no use. Doc said that Yellow House had more nerve than any man he ever saw. I guess he did. Much of the notoriety that grew up around the Millet Ranch and its riders stemmed from a series of events that began at a dance hall in the fall of 1879 at Seymour, the newly established seat of Baylor County. The town, 9 miles north of the ranch, had originally been called Oregon City, but the name was changed in September 1878 to honor a local cowboy named Seymour Monday. Fry Wilson, a Millet cowboy, attended the dance, got into an argument with a man named Sam Oldman, and in the best Millet tradition, pulled a gun. No shots were fired, but Wilson was arrested and fined $25. Declaring the fine excessive, Wilson refused to pay and returned to the ranch. A posse led by Seymour Constable Horma rode to the ranch. Enlisting the aid of Tom Peeler, Homra convinced Wilson to submit to arrest. The party returned to town, where Joe Ellis, another Millet range boss, paid the fine, and there the affair seemed to end. But animosity between Homra and Wilson continued to smolder, and in March 1880 burst into flame. The two men exchanged unpleasantries on a Seymour street and went for their guns. Wilson was quicker and shot the officer 3 times before Homra could get his weapon out. The wounds were non-fatal. Wilson pleaded self-defense at a hearing before Justice of the Peace, S. Edwards, and was released. This altercation came at a time when Seymour and newly organized Baylor County were in turmoil. The previous December, E.M. Stratton, editor of the Seymour paper and attorney for the county, hastily left town, saying that turbulent characters had threatened his life. On March 15th, bondsmen for Sheriff A.C. Tackett withdrew their support and forced him to resign. Within days, E.J. Thurmond, who had been appointed to replace the departed Stratton, also hit the trail, declaring that Seymour had been rounded up by ruffian elements who had shot the constable and chased out the county officials. Interest in the happenings in Baylor County became statewide when a special dispatch from Henrietta in Clay County appeared in the pages of the Galveston News. "A party of cowboys have virtually captured Seymour," said the Henrietta correspondent. After an inaccurate account of the events leading up to the latest trouble, the writer reported that 12 of Wilson's cowboy friends had confronted Homra with drawn pistols and allowed Wilson to shoot him 3 times. "The governor has been asked for assistance," the editor of the Henrietta Journal pointed out, that among the arms in the hands of the Millet revolutionists were rifles provided by order of the governor as a means of protecting their stock interests from Indian incursions. While there is about as much danger in that section of Indian invasions as there is danger here of a Turkish invasion. Several prominent citizens of Seymour rushed into print to deny the charges leveled against the Millet men. Stratton, it was said, had been full of mean whiskey and morphia for some time and suffered from a disordered brain. It was conceded that Thurmond's blowing had antagonized the cowboys, but no threats had been made against him. Tom Peeler insisted in a published statement that the story in the Galveston News was a tissue of lies. He also dismissed Stratton and Thurmond as too contemptible to notice. Reports of the dispute reached the office of Governor O.M. Roberts, who requested Adjutant General J.B. Jones to investigate. Acting on orders from Jones, Texas Ranger Captain G.W. Arrington, in early April, led a squad of Company C Frontier Battalion from the camp in Blanco Canyon to Seymour. "The Rangers had come," said a Millet cowboy, "to Christianize us with Winchesters and six-shooters." After 3 weeks in the area, Arrington filed his report. "Everything is quiet here at present," he told Jones. "The saloon has been closed the last few days, but opened again today." Judge E.R. Morris of Seymour also wrote to Jones, thanking him for sending in the Rangers. Captain Arrington arrived on Saturday last, and I am happy to say he found everything quiet. The whiskey gave out, and for the last 10 days, we have literally had a rest, while the grocery keeper has gone for more. Note at the end of article. Next month, Millet cowboy and gunman Jim Talbot trails the ranch's final drive to Caldwell, Kansas, where he engages in a bloody gun battle that haunts him for the rest of his life. We will read that article from the May 1991 edition of True West Magazine next week in the Western Magazine Hour. Here's an article from True West Magazine that dates back to 60 years. This is from the April 1961 edition of True West. Secrets of Panning Gold by Jimmy Walker. Editor's note. Some of the pictures on these pages might nudge the reader into thinking we've strayed away from burro tracks and hard rock miners and are trying to pull a hunk of glamorized wool over your eyes. This ain't true. But a lot of you folks prospect and are interested in prospecting. So we dug up this little how to do it up to present you with as much information on gold panning as we could. After all, prospecting hasn't changed much in the past 100 years, even though the looks of some of the prospectors have. That last sentence is probably a reference to a young woman who is in several of these pictures that was photographed panning for gold. For example, the first photo on this page, caption reads, "Some prospectors don't have beards." The one above is 5'7", 118 pounds, and 34, 20, 34. Definitely a caption that would date back to that era. This photograph is a picture of a young woman. She does have a big pan in her hand. There's some debris that's in the pan, and she's pouring water slowly out of it and into the creek bed, which she is kneeling next to. She looks to be blonde. She looks very intent on what she is doing. She's wearing a watch on her right hand, some dark-colored shorts, and a light-colored sweater, and is once again panning for gold. Here's the article. Although the old-time sourdough prospector is getting pretty scarce these days, his most important piece of equipment, the gold pan, is staging a comeback. Amateurs are getting into the hills on weekends and during vacations. Rock hounds are on the increase and don't a bit mind mixing a little gold panning with their hobby of collecting gemstones. Each year sees more campers, usually in family groups, invading the gold fields. Fortunately, the scenery in many gold-bearing areas is so spectacular that a camper consider his trip a success, even though his take from the pan is modest. He's not expecting to hit a bonanza. And besides, the investment in the pan isn't wasted. It makes a fine vessel for dishwashing. The process of gold panning is simple, and there's still money to be made, although a big strike is unlikely. The average gold panner, to be truthful, make something less than expenses. But even the rankest novice, if he follows the instructions, should have no difficulty in producing a show of color. What color? There's only one. Gold. Like every other hobby, success in gold panning depends on understanding the fundamentals. Where do you find gold? How do you pan? What's a positive method for identification? How do you separate flour gold from other concentrates? Where do you sell gold? These are typical greenhorn questions. The answers follow. All you need to know is to enjoy a fascinating pastime. The classic picture of a grizzled prospector, his burro, and his gold pan are associated in American folklore with the California Gold Rush of 1849. But it's a mistake to think that gold panning started no later than a century ago. The practice of washing gold from stream gravel has been around a long time. To give you an idea, gold washing is depicted on Egyptian monuments of the 4th Dynasty, 2900 BC. When an amateur sets out in search of gold, the first thing that interests him is a sure way to identify his findings. He doesn't want to spend his time accumulating a poke full of fool's gold. Neither does he relish tossing aside the real thing by mistake. Old-timers will say, "You won't need no books, sonny. When you see it, you'll know it." There's a lot of truth in that. Even the staid Encyclopedia Britannica admits that the metal has a resplendent luster. But a few hints on how to test for gold will be helpful until it can be recognized on sight. If all gold were pure, 24 karat, identification would be easier, for the precise color, specific gravity, and hardness is known. But most placer gold is alloyed with silver or copper, and this changes its physical properties. Pure gold is brass yellow, or gold-colored. If it's alloyed with silver, the color will be lightened in proportion to the silver content. If there is a large percentage of silver, it may appear silver white, with only a tint of yellow color. Besides providing a method of separation from the lighter materials, the weight of gold is also a good means for identification. The specific gravity is 19.3. This doesn't mean you have to hire a technician to compute the specific gravity of your samples. Gold is 6 times heavier than rock. This difference is so great that even tiny nuggets are noticeably heavy. The softness of gold is another key to its identification. Pure gold has a rating on Mohs scale of 2.5, about the same as your fingernail. Natural alloys will harden it, but a knife blade will scratch it easily. There's really no problem in distinguishing between gold and fool's gold. The only similarity is the color. Fool's gold is iron pyrites, a mixture of iron and sulfur. It cannot be scratched with a knife. It has a specific gravity of 5, somewhat heavier than ordinary sand, but much lighter than gold. It commonly occurs in crystal form, which gold does only rarely. If any doubt remains as to whether the particles are gold or iron pyrites, try pounding a piece with a hammer. Gold, the most malleable of all metals, will flatten without shattering. Pyrites will crumble and powder under the same treatment. Seasoned prospectors have learned, however, not to have contempt for pyrites. Gold is often found in association with them, and may even occur within the pyrites themselves, giving fool's gold a real value. To demonstrate the presence of gold in pyrites or in ore that contains no visible gold, a chemical test is required. Here is a simple test that can be performed in the field. You'll need small quantities of 3 chemicals: nitric acid, hydrolic acid, and metallic tin. Equipment needed is a piece of glass, filter paper, test tubes, test tube holder, eyedropper, and alcohol lamp. Prepare, no longer than 8 hours previous to the test, a stannous chloride solution by adding 1 or 2 small pieces of metallic tin to 2 cc of hydrochloric acid. Boil slightly. From the material you suspect contains gold, select an amount equal to a P and place in a clean test tube. Add 1 cc of nitric acid and 3 cc of hydrochloric acid. Boil over the lamp flame for 5 minutes or longer. The gold, if present, will now be in solution. Place a piece of filter paper on a clean piece of glass. Put 1 drop of the test solution on the filter paper and add 1 drop of stannous chloride solution. If gold is present, there will be a purple or rose-colored spot when the paper is dry. The more gold present, the darker the color will appear. To test low-grade ores, let the paper dry and add another drop of stannous chloride solution. Color will show plainer. The old saying, "Gold is where you find it," is not as true as another one, much more respected among prospectors: "Look for gold where gold has been found." The gold-bearing land in this country includes most of the far western states, Alaska, and a few southeastern states. The exact spots of gold mining activity can be located on maps published by several companies. Detailed information is usually available from the Bureau of Mining or the Department of Natural Resources of the individual states. By hunting in a place where gold has been found, your chances are much better than wildcatting blindly. But remember that you are not following a parade of professional prospectors and miners, not to mention hordes of eager amateurs like yourself. If you are to find gold, you'll have to know how to look for it. Get as far from the main roads as possible. The less accessible a spot is, the less likely it has been worked over. Stream placers are deposits of gravel and sand laced with a concentration of gold transported by water to its present location. Some placers are still being enriched by continual deposits of more gold. But don't forget that the same process has been going on for tens of thousands of years. Thus, ancient stream beds, rich with gold, might be easily overlooked if they bear no relation to existing water courses. Casual prospecting can be rewarding, even in a heavily worked stream, if you don't make the common mistake of thinking that the gold is distributed evenly over the stream bed. Concentrations of gold are located in spots. If you can find these spots, your take will be much greater than if you panned indiscriminately. The whole key to prospecting is to think of gold as a mineral with a higher specific gravity than anything else in the stream. Swift water will carry gold. Slowly flowing water will allow it to sink to the bottom. Investigate spots where the rate of flow decreases. This is where the river is most likely to dump its load. Look in eddies, beneath waterfalls, wherever the water makes a pause or change of direction. Investigate the inside curve of sharp bends. Coarser and richer gold sinks first, while the finer material is carried farther downstream. If your pan yields a showing of powdery or fine gold, try upstream for heavier pieces. Once settled in a stream bed, gold will sift down through the sand and gravel. It will keep sifting down, because of its weight, until it eventually reaches bedrock. The values at bedrock are many times those on the surface, and make it well worth the effort of shoveling away the overburden if there are encouraging colors. Pay attention to crevices and other irregularities in bedrock. These trap gold like the riffles of a sluice box, and sometimes are incredibly rich. Iron pyrites and black sand are good indications of gold. When these are spotted, it's always a smart idea to prospect. The black sand is heavier than the surrounding sand and settles in about the same manner that gold does. If black sand is present, you can be assured that conditions are favorable for the deposit of gold. Since the principle is well known, it's certain that the most obvious black sand deposits have been panned out. The secret of success in areas that have been worked over for years is to use a new gimmick, something the old-timers didn't have. The answer is the modern metal detector. In the past few years, technical advances have been made in this field, resulting in instruments ideally suited for gold prospecting. Portable, highly sensitive detectors can locate small deposits of gold and black sand at considerable depths. They can find virgin black sand deposits beneath the surface, unsuspected by the old-timers. In spite of the fact that panning is the least efficient and most laborious method of extracting gold, the use of the pan is as essential to the modern prospector as it was to the 49ers. A gold pan can be bought for about $2. The pan should be between 12 and 18 inches in diameter, with about 2.5 inches deep, and with sides having about a 30-degree slope. To describe the action of using a gold pan without demonstration is like trying to define a spiral staircase without using your hands. The technique can be best learned by practice and observation. The tricks of finding and identifying the gold, already outlined, are 90% of the game. Briefly, the pan is filled with sand and gravel and washed in water. The whole point is to concentrate the heavier materials by washing away the lighter. Large rocks should be discarded to keep the material as even a size as possible. Perhaps it's necessary to mention that any nuggets should be picked out and saved as they appear. The washing is continued until a concentrate of the heavier materials remains. If the gold is very fine, it usually will be in a mixture of black sand that cannot be separated by panning without risk of losing the gold. Save the concentrates for later separation. Let the concentrate mixture dry. Then use a magnet to dry out as much black sand as possible. The gold can be separated from the balance of the concentrates by amalgamation with mercury. Add about 1/2 tablespoon of mercury to 5 pounds of concentrate. Agitate vigorously underwater until no trace of gold remains. The gold will be taken up by the mercury, giving it a pasty consistency. The mercury can be panned free of the now worthless concentrate in the usual manner. Now you have a quantity of amalgam which must be further reduced until only gold remains. For the amateur, the simplest and safest procedure is to boil off the mercury. Place the amalgam in a clean iron vessel and heat to around 675 degrees Fahrenheit. The mercury is vaporized, leaving the gold. Warning: mercurial vapor is poison. Boil the amalgam outdoors and avoid inhaling the vapor. The gold is ready to sell. At this point, the question of markets becomes one of more than academic interest. Amounts less than 1 ounce can be peddled to individual buyers, mineral dealers, and jewelry stores at a discounted price. Larger amounts should be sold to a United States Mint. The gold can be sent by insured parcel post with a separate letter enclosing form TG-19, obtainable by request from any mint or assay office. The mints will pay $35 an ounce for pure gold, less for impure gold, and will deduct various charges for melting and refining. Gold panning still has its elements of suspense and high points of excitement. For today's amateur, as much as for history's old prospector. Take your kit up into them thar hills and start panning. Fort Knox needs the gold. True West, April 2021 edition. Dining in the Desert by Sherry Monahan. After exploring the natural beauty and history of the southwestern deserts, retreat to a historic oasis in Death Valley for fine dining and renewal. Immigrants, explorers, and miners all traversed the desert frontier and crossed some of the roughest terrain they'd ever seen. Some experienced it in wagons, others in stagecoaches, on horseback, and later by trains. Many traveled the Santa Fe Trail and were able to stop at Fort Union, where they obtained groceries, dishes, clothes, hardware, and more at the Post Trader store. Just past Renton, New Mexico, the three-story Clifton House offered amenities like food, water, and supplies. Further along the trail, they found the towns of Las Vegas and Santa Fe, New Mexico, which offered places to rest and eat. Those two towns flourished, and some 30 years later, became home to hotels and restaurants. Railroad passengers heading west could stop in Las Vegas at the Plaza Hotel, which opened in 1882. It was known as the Belle of the Southwest and offered travelers a respite from the heat. The hotel's first menu included cold meats, salads, relishes, cakes, nuts, and refreshments. By 1885, it upped its offerings and served baked trout, roast beef, shoulder of venison with jelly, chicken fricassee, lamb pot pie, oyster patties, stewed tomatoes, potatoes, pies, cake, and French drip coffee. The Spanish Trail connected to the California Road, and miners used it to explore treasures in the deserts of Amargosa Valley, Nevada, and Death Valley, California. In the mid to late 1800s, men headed into the mountains searching for gold and silver. They found some in places like Death Valley, but the real money was made when white gold, a.k.a. borax, was discovered. Aaron and Rosie Winters were some of the first to settle there and had a small house where they stored their flour and rice on a wall in the main living area and kept sugar, coffee, and tea under the bed. They also had some chickens, pigs, ducks, and cattle, and relied on pine nuts and mesquite seeds for flour when necessary. In 1883, William Coleman built Greenland Ranch because of the natural springs around it. The Harmony Borax Works housed the miners and freighters there who hauled the borax out of the valley. Coleman raised cattle, grew melons, sweet potatoes, and tomatoes, while others had vegetable patches and fruit trees, like oranges and figs. Freighters drove their 20 mule teams 165 miles to the nearest railroad and had to haul grain, hay, and water for the animals. They stopped at various springs along the 10-day route, and the swamper, who was the driver's assistant, served as the cook. After digging up sage roots and collecting grease brush, he cooked bacon, bread, beans, and canned goods. Canned peaches were used to make a cobbler for dessert and was served with coffee. The Furnace Creek Ranch, now the Inn at Death Valley, was built in 1927 on the site of Greenland Ranch. It was a working ranch with Hereford cows, alfalfa, kefir corn, wheat, oats, oranges, and vegetables. But most notable were the date palm trees. The Chronicle in Leavenworth, Kansas wrote, "Most interesting, however, are the young Deglet Noir date palms, of which there are 126, some placed by the government in the hope of obtaining pest-free nursery stock. Date palms still surround the Inn at Death Valley and are used in many of its recipes. Below is the historic bread recipe that can be found that can be made with dates from China Ranch Date Farm in nearby Tecopa, California. The ranch store, ChinaRanch.com, sells the date bread and several historic date varieties that have been grown at the ranch for 100 years. Date bread. Half cup white sugar, half cup brown sugar, 1 teaspoon baking soda, 1 teaspoon salt, 4 tablespoons stick butter, 1 cup water, 1/2 pound pitted and chopped dates, 1.5 cups flour, 1/2 cup walnuts chopped. Cream sugar, salt, and soda until light and fluffy. Add dates and water. Mix well. Add flour and mix for 1 minute. Add walnuts. Pour batter into a greased and lined tin loaf pan. Bake for 45 minutes at 325 degrees or until a toothpick comes out clean. Recipe, courtesy of the Oasis at Death Valley. True West, April 2021. Freedom, Independence, and Madness by Marshall Trimble. In many photos of Buffalo Bill, his hats are turned up on the right side. Do you know the reason why so many Old West characters did this? Alan Fonzenkemper, Fountain Hills, Arizona. A hat is an expression of an individual's freedom, independence, and style. They used to say you could tell whether a man was from Montana, Texas, or California by the crown of his hat. The brim, turned up right or left side, gives one the image of a swashbuckling Jeb Stuart type. And image, then and now, can be very important. When did the wagon trains going west come to an end? Jan Brown, Meridian, Idaho. From the 1840s to the 1860s, more than 300,000 pioneers crossed the plains and mountains of the West along various routes, including the Oregon and Santa Fe trails. The arrival of the transcontinental railroads and the branch lines off the main lines pretty much ended that era by the 1890s. Author David Derry writes in his Santa Fe Trail, there were still a few small wagon trains who made the trek west in the years that followed. Is it possible for horses to run themselves to death? Mike Anderson, Deer Park, Texas. Yes, a horse can die of dehydration, heart attack, and exhaustion if not rested periodically. Horses can run fast only so long, depending on the conditioning and the breed. Quarter horses are bred for shorter distances, while Arabian horses are noted for endurance. Even today, horses have died in the middle of a race or even afterwards. In wild terrain, you're actually better off to have a mule. What was prairie fever? John Volz, LaGrange, Kentucky. Prairie fever was also known as prairie madness. It affected settlers, mostly women, immigrating to the Great Plains following the Homestead Act of 1862. It was a depression, withdrawal, changes in personality that often led to violence, so it was an emotional issue. Women were often left behind while their husbands made the day-long wagon ride to a settlement for supplies. The solitude became too much to handle. In extreme cases, suicide or other violence was the result. A few years ago, author Glendon Swarthout wrote a best-selling book titled The Homesman that was later made into a movie starring Tommy Lee Jones and Hilary Swank. A homesman was a man hired by farmers whose wives succumbed to prairie fever. The men collected the stricken women and took them to nearby settlements where women's societies would try to locate their families in the East. If that failed, they would be taken to insane asylums in Chicago or other cities. Were there any fish in what is now called Donner Lake that would have kept the Donner Party from starving? Dale Sane, Ewan, Michigan. The immigrants were delayed several weeks by following the Hastings cutoff, which actually made them arrive late in the Sierra Nevada. They got caught in an early winter snowstorm, so the game was either holed up or had gone down to lower elevations, and the waters were frozen and couldn't be broken. The people were literally snowbound. Who is the man in the beginning of Gunsmoke who is shot down by Marshall Dillon? Veronica Boatwright, Glenville, Georgia. Arvo Ojala was the man who faced 6'7" Matt Dillon every Saturday night on Gunsmoke. He trained many Hollywood stars on how to handle a pistol, especially how to develop a realistic fast draw. He also designed the Buscadero used on screen in the early 1950s. Jim Lockwood told me a few years ago the studio got tired of paying Arvo every week for that brief gunfight scene. So they had Glenn Strange, who played Sam the bartender, take over the responsibility at no extra charge. Ojala said that over the years, the Gunsmoke residual monies bought him several new Cadillacs. Arvo did okay.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.